Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has two matters on its oral submission docket. They are Old American County Mutual Fire Insurance Company versus Zeferino Sanchez from Travis County and the 3rd Appellate Judicial District, and Tommy Thomas, Sheriff of Harris County, versus Gene Long from Harris County and the 14th Appellate Judicial District. In each matter, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We are taping these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of either argument from the clerk's office for a nominal fee. Justice Snyder will be sitting in these cases, but he is not here today at oral argument. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Old America.
May it please the court, Mr. Barry A. Chasnoff will present argument to the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning.
Appellee chose to save money in two ways, which have given rise to the issues in this case. First, he and his wife rejected the uninsured motorist and PIP coverage in their policy. And second,
Do we know that he actually rejected it?
Of course, it's our position that he authorized, among other things, that he authorized her. She was acting on his behalf.
Does it matter whether he actually knew about this or not?
Whether he had actual knowledge, we do not believe it matters, although there in the record is evidence that he must have known, because the declaration sent to him, declaration page, indicated that he did not have those coverages. Regardless of how this court holds on that rejection issue, however, if this court narrowly defines the term occupying in the Texas Standard Auto Policy and thus holds that Mr. Sanchez was not occupying his vehicle at the time of the accident, paradoxically, the court will be effectively denying coverage under the uninsured motorist coverage and personal injury protection to thousands of Texans injured while occupying vehicles which are covered. Court after court in this state and every other state which has looked at this occupying issue has broadly defined that term, specifically so that uninsured motorist and PIP coverage would be broadly available. And that's why all these decisions focus on whether the activity is vehicle-oriented, coming to the definition of occupying. Mr. Sanchez's problem in this case, among others, is that he was occupying or vehicle-oriented or working on a vehicle which he owned but had not listed as being covered. Thus, the policy does not extend the uninsured motorist protection or PIP coverage to him, even if he and his wife, or if this court holds that they had not rejected the coverage.
What if an adult child living with them had gone and done the same thing, purchased it for, say, his parents?
If an adult child, it is different. We believe that on the authority argument, we would get there also. But there are some arguments which we have which would not apply to the adult child.
Well, just in terms of the first issue that you were speaking of, the ability to waive the UM PIP coverage, could an adult child in the household who purchased the policy for the family affect a waiver?
On the authority argument, yes. The appellees in their brief say they do not dispute that an attorney in fact or someone with
authority. Well, but not authority so much as just the plain language. Would you consider them a named insured?
The adult child, no. But
so they could not then affect a waiver?
They could if they were acting as an agent for someone who was a named insured, if they had authority from someone who was a named insured. And there are a number of cases in other states which have looked at this issue and have come to that conclusion.
But you're not urging us to go that far. My understanding of your briefing was that as long as it's the first class of people insured, which would be within the definition of you and your named insured and the spouse, you'd take it a step further under this policy language, under my hypothetical.
If necessary to win, yes. But we don't think it's necessary to get that far. But if we do, we think that is an argument which also supports it.
I'm not clear who a named insured is in your view. Your brief on the merits says it's the wife and nobody else, or the spouse. And then the reply brief seems to pull back from that.
Yeah. A couple of terms. First of all, the named insured, which is a term of art, is the husband. But any insured named in the policy, which is what the statute says, we say includes the wife.
Well, your reply brief says at 11, and I quote, as a result, respondent's wife is, in effect, a named insured.
That's right. It is, in effect, a named insured. And I believe at that point of the brief, we're talking about the way the policy was worded at the time the legislature passed the statute. And at the time the legislature passed the statute, the wife was named, the spouse living in the house was a named insured as well, so clearly covered. Then we had the easy read policy change, which the Department of Insurance says we're not covering any, changing any coverages. So what we're saying there is that if you take that they weren't changing any coverages, and the way the legislature looked at it, named insured included the wife, then they would have been intending to include the wife as effectively a named insured.
The statute uses two phrases, of course, any insured named in the policy and named insured. Yes. Do you think those are different?
Well, if you look at the legislative history, there was a change. Early in the bill, it was named, that's the phrase that we're talking about, who can reject, was named insured, and then there was a change to any insured named in the policy. As the Court of Appeals said, they must have been doing something, and it appears to be a broader term. The legislative history does not say precisely why that change was made.
It doesn't make sense that it can be a broader term.
I understand what you're saying. I mean,
you track through the statute, you come up with the crazy idea that if the coverage was originally rejected by the spouse, the renewal policy must include the coverage. But if the coverage was originally rejected by a person listed in the declarations, the renewal policy doesn't have to include the coverage. That doesn't make any sense, does it?
It does not seem to make sense. The only thing that seems to make sense is that the legislature had in mind that the husband or wife or the spouses could reject, and that the rejection remained valid through the continuation of it unless they affirmatively state they want the coverage.
But if it doesn't make sense, then it looks to me like insured named in the policy, that phrase, has to either be be nothing more than named insured, the person listed in the declarations, or else named insured, which you say is a term of art, has to include the spouse. It won't work any other way.
I understand the argument. I think that there is the only thing that indicates that it means something different is the apparent conscious decision by the legislature to change the term as they track through the bill from named insured to any insured named in the policy.
But they didn't change it everywhere.
That is correct.
And so
they did not.
Should we assume that there was a method to that?
A method to that madness?
I didn't say that.
I understand, Your Honor. But I did. In trying to track through, it is not clear. We found no cases. We found nothing in the legislative history. I don't want to mislead you into thinking there is something there that is not. It appears that they were thinking of something when they changed it. But it also appears when looking at it that they thought named insured meant the husband and the spouse, and that why they made that particular change in the language. It appears to be making it broader, but they did not enlighten us anymore as to their thinking.
And you concede that from any kind of logical sense, Mr. Sanchez is not upon this car.
No.
But you say that cases go elsewise, and that's good public policy, and old American is willing to pay a whole bunch of PIP claims out there for the greater good.
Well, they are an insurance company which will pay those claims which they should pay, and they are not going to take a position to save money which they think is counter to what is clearly the intent. And to broaden or to narrow this definition cuts a lot of people out of coverage, which they understand the Texas Department of Insurance want covered. We cite in our brief a case, the Kentucky case of the Transport Insurance Company. It's a 94 decision, but it in turn relies upon a Kentucky Supreme Court case, the Kentucky Farm Bureau case, which is cited in there. And that's just briefly a pregnant daughter-in-law who gets out of her father-in-law's car, goes to flag a for help, and is struck and killed. And she is some many yards away from the car at the time, and they have a look at how broadly one defines occupying to see if she was going to have coverage. And they looked at the string cite a number of states, the states that have gone to the broad definition of occupying, and they go to the broad definition of occupying as being what is in the public interest, and they set forth a four-part test for occupying in that Kentucky Supreme Court case, and we believe that this court should consider that test or some other to give clarity to occupying and to go the way that the majority or the vast majority of other states are going on this issue, and to provide PIP and uninsured motorists to the broadest spectrum of citizens. Now, on the rejection, as I said, we believe that she rejected it. Therefore, we have a number of arguments as to that, among others not highlighted in our brief that are of importance. The authority argument, we think this case has a lot
there's
of...
No evidence of authority, is there?
Well, we believe there is. We believe this case has a lot of similarities, and I hope I pronounced correctly, to a decision written by Chief Justice Phillips and Urrutia. We think there would be a logical disconnect to say she doesn't have the authority, that she has the authority to sign the application which obtains the insurance, but not the authority to reject the coverages. Urrutia is a case involving a truck rental agreement where the issue was whether the agreement was valid when the agreement was not attached to the insurance policy. And writing for unanimous court, the Chief Justice said, the Court of Appeals did not explain why the rental contract was void for the purpose of defining Urrutia's coverage, but valid for the purpose of making Urrutia an insured in the first place. We have exactly the same situation here, that there's a logical disconnect between saying that she had the authority to get the application, therefore buying the insurance company to provide the coverage, but not the authority to reject the coverages.
But I'm curious as to what when those arguments were made, do you mean she could have had the authority or she actually did have, he said to her, go do this?
There's not evidence in the record that he said to her, go do this. But she represented in signing the application. There are four places where she signs. One's just giving authority, a proxy authority. But the other places, specifically with those relating to this statute, she says, I am rejecting these coverages under the terms of 5.061 and the other place 5.06-3, which means, and she's charged with knowledge of what she's signing and of the law, and so she's saying, I know that I'm rejecting this as an insured name under the policy, and she also says, I recognize if something I misrepresent, if I misrepresent something, the policy's void.
Do you know if I could just go buy an auto insurance policy for a friend as a gift?
You probably don't have an insurable interest there, and so other than that,
issue, but I'm not claiming any. I just want to buy my friend needs insurance, and so I say, well, I'll buy you a policy. So I go in to the agent, and I say, I want a policy for Joe Smith.
I think you could do that. In terms of whether you could reject the coverages, which we're talking about here, it would. You are a lawyer, and if you were his attorney, in fact, for purchasing it, even the plaintiff, the appellee, would agree that you could reject those coverages.
But if I were just a friend, just or you know, somebody at church says, you know, poor old Joe needs insurance, so I think, well, I'll help. I can do that. So I go down and buy a policy, I claim any interest in it. Don't want any interest in it, but I don't want to pay any more than I have to. So I figure, well, I'll buy the minimum coverage and I'll reject this. Can I do that?
I believe you cannot. If you are not acting as his attorney, in fact, if you don't have the authority to reject on his behalf, the state would say there's
so I can
coverage.
Buy coverage for him, but I just can't reject that.
It is different than other coverages that you can reject. One other quick point, I was talking about Arrudia before. We think it helps us on another point in terms of the question as to whether there was authority.
And what's that other point, briefly?
Okay. That is the red light. It is that Arrudia also talks about the application being part of the policy because the application refers to the terms of the policy and is a necessary part of it. And you know, the application says, I'm applying for the policy based upon the statements in here. There are other things she agreed in writing, as I've talked about, that it's part of it. And she is named. Her name appears in the application. If it's part of the policy, then she is an insured named in the policy.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Glenn C. Turkwand and Mr. Charles C. Sanders will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Turkwand will open with the first 7 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I will be addressing this morning briefly the two exclusionary provisions, and Mr. Sanders will address the PIP and UM rejection. I think it's noteworthy, and the Chief Justice attempted to ask Old American whether we have, in fact, addressed the issue of a pop occupying merely by virtue of the fact that there was a stipulation that Mr. Sanchez was under his vehicle, lying under his vehicle. The distinction I believe that Old American fails to make is one of inclusion, affording coverage, or exclusion where there's an exclusionary provision. And this court, long tradition in public policy, has strictly addressed the exclusionary provisions, and this is where Mr. Sanchez is seeking coverage.
But do you think the same word can be read differently for inclusion and exclusion?
I think it has been in this sense, that where an insured is attempting to get coverage, the term occupying is read as broadly as possible as in order to afford coverage for that individual. We have some cases where the individual has just left to repair the wheel on the car, or is just going around to the side to push the vehicle. And in affording coverage, courts have read occupying very broadly. However, in an exclusionary provision, which we have in this case, Justice Hecht, we have to read that strictly, and we have to look to occupying, see if occupying is in fact defined within the policy. It is, and by all accounts, we've agreed that upon is the operative word, and upon under are in opposites, and in fact, the antonym of upon would be under or beneath. And that's our situation.
We don't know anything about the facts except what we have from the stipulations.
That's correct. Plus what's available to us in the policies that were attached to the stipulations and before the trial court as well as this court.
Well, we don't know whether Mr. Sanchez got out of the car or out of the truck and crawled under it, or if he went away for 2 days and came back, or any of that.
This court has not afforded that luxury of the facts because it was tried to the bench. But this court is bound by, and the Court of Appeals found itself bound by, the stipulations. And the stipulations were unequivocally that he was lying under his vehicle at the time. The court hasn't asked and didn't address the standby provisions and the exclusionary provisions. I do not think that there's any dispute, but they've raised it certainly in their argument before this court. This court has addressed the standby provisions, and briefly we ask that you simply affirm that. In this case, the causative force of this unfortunate situation was an uninsured motorist who crashed into Mr. Sanchez's vehicle. And unless the court has any questions specifically on the standby provisions or further regarding the occupying provisions, I would prefer to pass the torch to Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. My issue is rejection of PIP and UM coverage. And in order to understand that issue, I think it's necessary to look into the policy and see a little bit more about the concept behind the phrase named insured or any insured name in the policy. I do not concede and do not believe that the policy, an insurance contract, should govern and control legislative intent in the statute.
You heard my questions to petitioner. Do you think that the phrase any insured name in the policy and the phrase named insured in the statute have to be read to be equivalent one way or the other?
I believe that both phrases are the same in that each phrase requires that the name actually appear in the policy. Now, what the legislature intended...
Because otherwise it's not going to make any sense.
I believe that, my personal opinion is that the phrases are the same. I've been doing insurance work for a lot of years, and that's my personal view.
How do you respond to his argument that at the time these statutes were enacted, the legislature had before the Texas Family Auto Policy, which said that named insured also included a spouse if the spouse was a resident of the same household?
Okay. Well, again, I don't know that the legislature is looking at the Family Auto Policy to determine its intent in setting up a methodology for rejecting PIP and UM coverage.
Well, they were debating PIP coverage specifically, according to the
briefs. Yes.
And they were worried about fault versus no fault and what the federal government might do. So they clearly were talking about the personal injury in the auto policy in Texas, and that was reformed at the time. Shouldn't we presume that they knew what the policy said, and when they chose the words named insured, that they were looking at that policy?
I would respond and point you to the case of Howard versus INA, where Judge Hankinson writes that intent of the contracting parties is not a factor in looking at the UM statute to see if, and PIP statute to see if there was valid waiver.
I was asking about the legislature's intent.
I'm sorry?
I was asking about the legislature's intent.
Yes. But following my reasoning, that means that the legislature, in setting up this UM and PIP waiver methodology, did not necessarily intend that to rest on contract principles and contract foundation. In other words, that methodology anticipates that a certain person, a named insured, will waive coverage a certain way in writing. Once that occurs, then the policy issues and is delivered to the insurer. That policy then is the contract. So in setting up the methodology, the legislature is looking for a way to be guarded of giving away UM and UIM and PIP coverages and restricting that and not making it so easy, although that is mentioned.
Let me ask you, if you were looking, if this case arose under the Family Auto Policy, would your position be the same?
Yes.
Even though the definition was different?
you know, the definition of name, which were specifically included as spouse.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Judge. Let me, if I can, turn to the personal auto policy for just a minute. The personal auto policy defines you and your as meaning, as including the named insured named in the declarations and also a spouse of residence of the household. And petitioner said, therefore, they're the same or interchangeable for purposes of the policy. But that's not correct, and I want to show you why. If you look at the personal auto policy under the section style termination, you'll see that's on page 11 of the policy. You will see that only the named insured in the declaration and not the non-named spouse can terminate the policy. That's a fundamental.
But it also says shown in the declarations, which is omitted from the statute. It doesn't say any named insured shown in the declarations.
I'm sorry?
You're reading out under the termination clause, it says the named insured shown in the declarations. And the statute just says any named insured. It doesn't say any named insured shown in the declarations. So that argument could cut both ways, couldn't it?
Well, it says the policy may be canceled during the policy period as follows. A, the named insured shown in the declarations may cancel by returning this policy to us. Now, what that doesn't say is this policy may be canceled by you. You is defined to include named insured and spouse. The spouse cannot cancel the policy. The spouse isn't given that right under this policy, nor in the statute on cancellation, in the insurance code. Okay, what about, let's say that the spouse and her husband want to cancel the policy. They find a better deal, cheaper insurance with another carrier. Who has the right under statute and in this policy to terminate the present policy and purchase other insurance? Excuse me, just terminate this policy. Okay? I'm sorry, that is the spouse. The insurance company, if the insurance company wants to cancel the policy, there's a 10-day notice requirement. Who is entitled to receive that 10-day notice? Written notice, the named insured only, not the spouse. We may cancel by mailing at least 10 days notice to the named insured shown in the declarations at the address shown in this policy. You see, the spouse isn't entitled to this important statutory notice. Now, what about non-renewal? At the end of the policy, let's assume it's a one-year policy, 12 months. At the end of that time, the statute requires a 30-day notice to non-renew so that the insured can make other arrangements. Okay? Who is entitled statutorily to that notice?
Down at the bottom. The briefing, it seems like both sides say the case law supports their position in other states. Do you have any cases from other states that directly support your position? It seems like you distinguish their cases, but there aren't any that actually go your way.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
I cited secondary authorities. Probably shouldn't have done that. There are cases in the ALR article that I cited. There are three cases cited, and also in Appleman on insurance, he cites, I believe, two cases, Florida case, Alabama case, and I believe there's a California case. I can provide those to you later.
So you agree the case law has gone the other way in other jurisdictions?
Only in one case. The reason for that is our situation is unique. Our personal auto policy is somewhat unique. Our concept of the named insured is somewhat unique. The named insured does not, the spouse of the named insured does not get, not entitled to statutory notice of non-cancellation of the policy.
And that's unique to Texas, you think?
I don't know that that's unique to Texas, Your Honor, because I don't know the laws of every state. I'm familiar with the laws of some states. The only time in the personal auto policy of Texas, you see, the insurance company needs someone to be the spokesman for the policy. Someone has to be in charge of the policy.
If it's routine to just list one spouse?
In Texas, I can only tell you what, I don't know this for sure, okay, because people don't know what different insurance companies do. But many insurance companies, as my understanding is, they do the rating based on the man or the title holder of the vehicle, and they only name one named insured. So that if you want to be a named insured also, the insurance company could put your name on the declaration page along with your wife, or they could do it by endorsement as an additional named insured. But you see, if you look over at the next page, page 12 on the policy.
You say endorsement, would you have to pay a premium for that?
I'm sorry?
Would you have to pay an additional premium for the endorsement?
Sometimes you do.
Even though you're already covered?
You do in a CGL policy. I'm not sure about the personal auto policy. If the spouse becomes a named insured and it's a she, her coverage is increased. You see, the spouse is subject to lose her coverage if she leaves the household, with exception is if it's in contemplation of divorce. The spouse is subject to lose her coverage, if it's a her, in the event of divorce. We have the Wallace case where a spouse complains, look, I was married to him when we bought this policy. I was married to him when we paid for the policy out of community funds just because he's the named insured. And here we get divorced 5 days later after divorce. I've got no coverage. She has no coverage. Now, the household, the spouse's rights to coverage are even contingent upon these things. If you have two households, if you have for example, let's say my wife finds a job opportunity in Houston, and she goes to Houston and establishes a household there. I'm the named insured on the policy. She is no longer a spouse resident of my household, and she's not contemplating divorce. She just lost her coverage, or a big part of her coverage. Now, some of the coverage will run with the automobiles, but I'm talking about that first class of coverage. You see, the spouse is more of a beneficiary under the policy. That's the concept. The contracting party and the party that has the right to make the important decisions on the policy is the named insured. That's our system. That's our concept of named insured in Texas. The named insured, if you look.
But in this case, you agree that the wife could go in and buy the policy for the husband and pick every coverage and the amount of coverage except the PIPUMUIM.
So can a girlfriend.
Right.
So can a law clerk. It's because in contract formation for insurance policies, the application, it isn't like in real estate where you have an offer and acceptance.
So it seems to me under your theory, the only person who can reject the coverage has to be the person who's named in the declarations. Because you've got a theory about actual authority, but no insurance company is going to go check, make sure somebody file an attorney in fact or something.
Or named in the endorsement. That's what the legislature said. Yes. If you look at page 12 where it says transfer of your interest in the policy, what happens when the spouse dies? Okay? If the spouse dies, nothing happens to the insurance of the named insured. It's just like when there's a divorce. If it's a him, his insurance marches right along. She's got to go get other insurance because she's no longer married. Because he's the named insurer, he's not a spouse. Now, the surviving spouse. However, if a named insured shown in the declarations dies, coverage will be provided for, one, the surviving spouse if resident in the same household at the time of death. Coverage applies to the spouse as if a named insured shown in the declarations. That's the only time I know in the personal auto policy where the spouse actually has the same rights as a named insured, is if he dies. She is elevated to that status. And in the second phrase, number two there explains that that's also true of a legal representative of the deceased person, and he or she would accede to the rights of the named insured. This is the concept of named insured. Now, when the legislature, to get back to Justice Owen's question, when the legislature was figuring out this methodology for waiving PIP and UM coverages, and it had to select some persons got to do this, it selected named insured, because, and that's in keeping with the authority and the special position that a named insured has in the insurance policy that we have.
But the named insured was defined differently in the policy the legislature was looking at the time. That was my point. And I still haven't heard your response to that.
Well, let's take a look at that policy. The family policy, okay. Well, first of all, I would note that under the definition section, it says under Part Number 1, named insured, quote, means an individual named in Item 1 of the declaration and also includes his spouse. So the policy itself is making a distinction between the two. Named insured includes the individual named and a spouse. Okay, now it says definitions, and this definition is controlling under Part Number 1, colon. Part Number 1 is the liability section of this insurance policy. It's not the UM or the PIP statute in the insurance code. So our commissioner of insurance is at that time putting out a form that uses this terminology to be more efficient, actually, in describing the liability coverages. For this to leap into the legislative enactment, I think is a matter of, again, I think we have contracts controlling statutes and not vice versa, my view of it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Some quick points in response. First of all, on this issue of whether a term can be defined twice the same way and different ways in the same contract, refer the court to this court's decision in 1990 in Gonzales versus American Insurance Company, where you said it could not be. And in this case, in the policy we're talking about, terms occupying appear in the inclusion and exclusion on page 6 of the policy within about an inch or an inch and a half of each other. And counsel would have us define it two different ways on the same page of the contract. Like I said, the court's already addressed that issue. Cannot do it. The question was asked about citations. The answer is these other citations to cases that go the other way, when you dig into them, aren't there. For example, Appleman. Appleman cites two cases. It's true that go the other way. Two Florida cases, both later reversed by not those cases, but the principles reversed later by the Florida Supreme Court in subsequent decisions. Then counsel argued that there was only one case that went the other way. In their brief, they referred to that as the Supreme Court of Arkansas case, Daniels versus Colonial Insurance. But first of all, we say there are a number of cases that go the other way, and the distinctions drawn don't go to the substance of the issue. But the way they distinguish this Daniels case is not valid. Court of Appeals just said, well, it doesn't refer to the statutory language. I'm not sure why that is a distinction. But Appalee goes further in his brief and says that the statute in effect at the time of that decision allowed rejection, quote, by the named insured or by an applicant, and therefore, you know, it's a different case than ours. In fact, though, although there had been a statute passed that year in Arkansas that said that in 93, the fact is that statute in effect at the time of the accident in question is like ours, does not refers to the named insured. So you have to look into those cases and go beyond them. Fact is, the Arkansas Supreme Court case is on all fours with this one.
Is it typical to name one spouse in the declarations and not the other one?
Some companies most companies tend to do that. In fact, I did a little checking of this, and they name one or the other. Sometimes it's the female. One of the matters I happened to check was a female member of USAA where they named her and not her husband. I don't know if it's a matter of convenience or just what has grown up over the years, but it seems to be. It's not a scientific survey by any means. Quick point, reference was made to the standby. I think we're talking about the struck by provision. The Court of Appeals and respondent rely on the Kahn case and the causative force aspect of the Kahn case. This court, 12 years later in Gallo, said, in essence, you know, when we talked about causative force in Kahn, it was an impermissible amplification of the policy language, and we should just look at what the policy means. So this court looked specifically at what they're relying on, the Kahn case, causative force, and said we ought to go with the literal, with the common meaning of struck by, and not go through these amplifications. And that's the 74 decision of Gallup in the Gallup case. In this case, in our case, it appears to be no question that he was struck by this car. He was hit by his car. It was not a stationary object at the time of the incident. It was hit and hit him.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.